A nation in shock today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Deadly attacks on two mosques in New Zealand have shattered that country's sense of security.
Things like this just do not happen here, so people are in a state of shock.
And half a world away, here in the U.S., a sense that violence against a faith community is all too familiar.
It feels like it happened right here, right down the street, in some ways.
Also on the show today, American kids join the global movement to demand action on climate change.
I would prioritize the environment and climate change in front of all my other interests, like feminism, because it's like impending doom, while other things could wait a little longer.
She makes a pretty good point. The stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
It is clear that this is one of New Zealand's darkest days.
That's New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
What has happened here is an extraordinary and unprecedented act of violence.
It is unprecedented, and the voices of witnesses and survivors underscore that. What some of them saw in Christchurch, as you're about to hear, is hard to listen to.
I was driving just outside the mosque. And I saw to my right lots of people running, and they were running for their lives. And I said, whoa, something's happening here. And then the next second, there was rapid fire, and these people were being knocked down like tenpins. Right opposite where I was driving, I saw them being hit from behind, and they were falling to the ground.
I was hearing shooting after shooting after shooting. I could hear screaming and crying, and I saw some people were, you know, drop dead, and some people were running away. I was on the wheelchair. I could not go anywhere, and also I didn't want to because I was afraid what was going to happen to the ladies, what was going to happen to my wife.
Suddenly from the window, which was on my left, gunshot came in, and I could see people getting hit in the head, in the shoulders, in the legs, and everywhere. And I was just waiting that I might get hit too. I was keep checking my legs and body that if I'm hit or not. So I closed my eyes and I tried to call home so that I could talk to them for one last time, because that's what I felt right now, that I should talk home even if I got shot.
And the worst thing was we could hear the ambulances, but they couldn't get to us. And the other guy I could see was, he was in bad shape, but I couldn't get to him because that was where directly the gunfire was coming from. I'm 66, never thought in my life I'd love to see something like this, not in New Zealand.
I cannot believe my eyes what I saw today, never expected, because I've been living here for 5 years and I know that New Zealand is one of the safest country, but I'm so scared now.
Survivors and witnesses of the massacre at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Four suspects have been arrested. Their messages suggest they were driven by white supremacy.
Things like this just do not happen here, so people are in a state of shock.
Chelsea Daniels is a reporter with radio station Newstalk ZB in Auckland.
We see these things on world news, you know, we turn on the TV, we see things in America, we see things in the UK, Paris, those big names, but no one thought that Christchurch will be added to the list. Here in New Zealand, this is unprecedented for us. Not only have we never had a terror attack, we've never had a mass shooting of this size. The last major shooting event in New Zealand would be in 1990. That was huge, and that was nearly 30 years ago.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said in a national address, "We were not chosen for this act of violence because we condone racism. We were chosen for the fact that we are none of these things. It was because we represent diversity and kindness." What do New Zealanders hear when they hear that? Would the majority agree with that statement in 2019?
Absolutely, a majority would agree with that statement. New Zealanders are renowned for their kindness, for their openness, especially when it comes to different cultures. I mean, there's not been any animosity towards different groups like there has been, perhaps, you know, in our cousins in Australia. But here, it's completely out of the blue. People have asked me today, has there been this underlying kind of white supremacist, nationalist kind of group just waiting in the shadows? But no, I don't think there has. This has caught everyone by surprise.
Muslims represent less than 1% of the population in New Zealand, but do these Muslim New Zealanders run into a lot of Islamophobia? I mean, had there been any concern among the community that an attack might happen, could happen?
No. And I mean, we talk to the Muslim community here in New Zealand when something happens overseas, just to check in with them, saying, are people, you know, being cruel towards you? You know, are you okay? What do you think? And no, not really anything of this caliber.
Reporter Chelsea Daniels in Auckland. The news from New Zealand is devastating. Dozens of people gathered at two mosques, murdered. Friday is the day of worship and weekly services at mosques, and so when American Muslims woke up to the news this morning, on a day of prayer, it hit especially hard. Tahira Amatul Wadud is a board member of the Council on American-Islamic Relations here in Massachusetts.
I think the initial reaction has been shock and then horror because, you know, as details come out, and it's my 17-year-old who breaks news to me this morning as to how many casualties there were. And how real this was for her. Even though it's a world away, the attack was designed to be in our faces, and that is actually the result that we're seeing. It feels like it happened right here, right down the street in some ways.
I mean, one of the roles of religion, of course, is to bring people together. On a day like this, do you sometimes just want to crawl away and not be a part of anything?
No, I feel, and especially with my experience dealing not only with anti-Muslim sentiment, but watching this growing rise of anti-religious sentiment, I've recognized that people want to be together when these things happen. When the attacks happened in Pittsburgh of the synagogue, people came together in vigil. When Dylann Roof massacred Black worshipers in the South, people came together in vigil. And that's what I see. And I think that's also what's healthy for people.
But is it safe to be together?
I'm thinking about the Birmingham church bombing in 1963, 10 years before I was born. That did not deter people from worshiping. That did not deter people from gathering and fighting from a spirit of activism that was led by faith. So we know that there's risk. We know that there's exposure, but will that deter people from gathering? I most certainly hope not. And in fact, it has the opposite effect on me. It makes me want to be in community at the house of worship even more so.
So I'm curious to know what you think of this one detail from New Zealand that really struck me. The police there telling members of the public to stay away from mosques because of security concerns. I mean, do you worry that's letting extremists have their way?
Oh, I think it certainly does. And the thing is that it also compounds isolation. And I think that becomes the tragedy. Without having a strategy behind why you might say to someone, don't gather at this moment, seems like you're giving in to fear. And that I reject.
So you're an attorney, Tahira, and you represent Islamburg, a Muslim community in upstate New York that has been threatened by white supremacists. And we're seeing this narrative again in New Zealand. We believe. Are governments doing enough to address white extremism and white supremacy?
The greatest threat to the United States of America is white supremacy. It is white nationalism. We're seeing that manifest here in our country, but we're also seeing it manifest globally. And we need to, as a citizenry, push and support our public officials, push and support our Department of Justice in identifying and pursuing the proper threat. So no, the government is not doing all that it can do. It needs to fund and continue the research and continue to root out white supremacy wherever it exists, and particularly where it poses a violent threat to other Americans and people throughout the world.
Today being the Islamic Day of Prayer, can I ask you what you're thinking about and praying for today?
I'm thinking about, my children go to a very small Muslim school, and on Fridays they open the doors to the public for Juma prayer. And I would not be telling the truth if I told you that I wasn't worried, and that I'm not worried, because I'm worried about that. But I don't let that fear keep me from sending them to school. But it's a scary thing. It's a scary thing.
Tahira Amatul Wadud, a board member with the Council on American Islamic Relations here in Massachusetts. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for reaching out.
Later on The World, how social media amplified the terrorist attack in New Zealand. It's been 6 years since this song was unavoidable. Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. When Psy came out with Gangnam Style, it brought K-pop to the global stage. Even Western music fans couldn't resist the charm of Korean pop music. But now the bond between fans and their music idols is damaged. A sprawling K-pop scandal has rocked South Korea. Allegations of sex crimes and police collusion tied to nightclubs. One musician caught up in the scandal, Seungri. He's with a boy band called Big Bang. To understand why this news is so big, we turn to journalist Kelly Kasulis.
I do think it was a shock in general just because the main K-pop star that we're talking about, Seungri, he's really kind of beloved in South Korea. I mean, just a few weeks ago, before all of this happened, I remember seeing him on a variety show on television, and a person next to me, three times his age, really, was just talking about how much she loved him and like believed he was a great thing for South Korea. He's really so admired across generations. So in that sense, it is really surprising that he would be involved with all this. But at the same time, South Koreans are definitely becoming more aware of sexual assault, the issue of filming women performing sex acts or being raped without their knowledge and consent of that film. There's been a lot of issues about spy cameras in bathrooms.
I mean, it does kind of play into the Me Too movement and the whole theme. How are Korean women seeing this?
A lot of Korean women have wanted these K-pop stars out of the bands altogether the moment that these allegations first surfaced. Pretty much all of the stars involved have either resigned from the entertainment industry or been kicked out from the company representing them. And a lot of K-pop fans, as well as South Korean female activists, have been petitioning for this, demanding this on social media. And I think that's definitely a part of this greater Me Too movement.
How far could this scandal go?
You know, I think that there will probably be more probes in the future as far as celebrities and K-pop stars go. Already, South Korea has been experiencing kind of this general trend of crackdowns on rich families, wealthy families, influential people, company CEOs, etc. in the last couple of years. So it's really interesting. I think that in South Korea and the rest of the world, there's kind of this growing case for how power and money can so easily be abused in this country, as well as this issue with influential people, you know, affecting law enforcement. I mean, right now we have a police official, at least one, who is being accused of covering up a drunk driving incident involving a K-pop star, as well as helping keep this nightclub and its shady activity under wraps for a long time. So I think, if anything, we're just going to see more suspicion and more investigations.
Journalist Kelly Kasulis in Seoul, thanks very much for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you as well.
Just ahead, the college admission scandals. Yeah, there's actually more than one. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Operation Varsity Blues, that's what the FBI calls its investigation into a massive bribery conspiracy over college admissions. It involved movie stars and CEOs paying more than $1 million, in some cases, to manipulate the college admission system for their kids. I'm here with higher education reporter Kirk Carapezza with our WGBH partners. He's been following the story, as well as another big, not entirely unrelated story, a discrimination lawsuit against Harvard University. It has been one heck of a week for education news, Kirk. What are college admissions officers telling you?
Well, I think the news that a lot of wealthy movie stars and designers and CEOs were willing to pay, in some cases, millions of dollars to get their kids into elite schools shocked many of us, right? This case calls into question the very idea that America is a meritocracy. But many people who work in higher education are not surprised. They say the admissions process has become such an incredible frenzy, and there's this assumption that wealthy families will try to buy their way in one way or the other.
So that was the big news this week. Then there's the ongoing story of a lawsuit against Harvard, Kirk. It's getting sued for alleged discrimination against Asian Americans. What can you tell us about that case?
Right. Harvard is being sued for allegedly discriminating against Asian American applicants, holding them to higher personal and academic standards. The plaintiffs say Harvard is stereotyping them as one-dimensional, perpetual foreigners. Harvard has denied those charges, and Harvard says that Asian Americans now make up nearly a third of the students there. So how could they be discriminating against Asian Americans?
And there's a similar lawsuit in California, right?
Yes. While we wait on the outcome of the Harvard case, the University of California system is facing a similar lawsuit with allegations that administrators may be considering race in admissions, even though California bans the practice. When he was running for California's state Senate last fall, Republican businessman George Shen says he often heard from Asian American families convinced they were being discriminated against in college admissions.
So in many of the town hall meetings or a public forum, they will bring this up. You know, what will be my position? The more I got involved politically, the more I noticed that people are really concerned about that.
I met Chen at a restaurant recently in the heart of a suburban Chinatown near L.A. He's 62, the son of Chinese immigrants, and says he didn't realize until last year that some Asian Americans were concerned that they were being held to higher academic and personal standards in college admissions.
We were told if we play by the rule, work hard, we'll be rewarded. So what we don't want is having two sets of different rules.
Shen lost his state Senate race, but then formed a group that's helping fund a current lawsuit against the University of California system, a lawsuit led by a UCLA professor, Rick Sander, a longtime critic of considering race in admissions.
The longer I work on affirmative action, the more I think that using racial preferences is highly addictive for universities.
Sander wrote a controversial book, Mismatch, which argues that considering race hurts the students it's intended to help by thrusting them into top programs they may not be academically prepared for. Several studies have dismissed that idea, countering that qualified minorities do better in more selective schools. But Sander stands by his theory.
It's a travesty to admit students without at least providing full disclosure that this is a problem that a lot of students are having.
Sander wants the UC system to give him troves of admissions data to determine whether admissions officers have secretly considered race in admissions, even though California voters banned it in 1996.
We're not suing the university for discrimination. We're suing the university for information with which we want to decide whether there's discrimination going on. If so, where?
He points to a 2014 admission study by UCLA sociologist Robert Mayer that found Asians are disadvantaged throughout the admissions process.
What Mayer said is that if we control for individual qualifications, African Americans and Latinos are systematically advantaged. There's some disturbing evidence of discrimination, which I think is very hard to dispute.
The University of California is disputing that evidence and states that it does not consider race, ethnicity, or gender in admissions. UC is the largest public higher ed system in the U.S. with more than 238,000 students. For years, UC says it's used race-neutral methods to attract the most diverse student body as possible. Admissions officials weigh grades and test scores, but also personal characteristics. UC says the data Sander wants isn't so easy to hand over. It protects students' privacy and isn't required by law.
I do have mixed feelings about this because as a civil rights attorney that is often questioning governmental conduct, I do believe in very open access to information.
Nicole Ochi is a lawyer in L.A. with Asian Americans Advancing Justice, a human rights group. Ochi has been representing students who testified in support of Harvard in the discrimination case in Boston. She sees similarities between the two lawsuits.
Both use Asian Americans as a wedge in this debate around the use of race in the admissions process. And in both cases, there's Asian American groups that had never existed before, came out of the woodwork to be plaintiffs.
Ochi dismisses the allegation that the University of California intentionally and systematically discriminates against Asian Americans in a state where they make up 13% of the college-age population, but more than one-third of all UC undergrads.
I think it's pretty clear that Asian Americans are not being excluded from the UC system, that race is not being used to penalize them.
In the Harvard discrimination case in Boston, none of the anonymous Asian American plaintiffs testified. And during a recent final hearing, Judge Allison Burroughs said that was a problem in proving intentional discrimination. In California, when I asked UCLA's Rick Sander and businessman George Shen to help identify Asian American students who claimed they were unfairly denied admission based on their race, none came forward. Shen says that shouldn't matter in this public records lawsuit.
This is a cultural thing. Asians don't like to, rock the boat.
And Marco, George Shen tells me he's convinced that the University of California is hiding something. A court hearing to determine the merits of the lawsuit is expected later this year.
Reporter Kirk Carapezza, I'm curious, the two big education stories we're talking about here, on one hand, Asian students claiming they are being discriminated against. On the other hand, wealthy kids and their parents bribing their way into college. What is the connection between the two stories? Is there one?
Well, those who think the consideration of race should be banned are now using the bribery case to argue that we need to completely overhaul the system. Now, the Harvard discrimination case exposed a special list of donors and alumni who were given what they call an extra tip in the admissions process, and it's not unusual for colleges to keep such a list.
How are supporters of considering race in admissions reacting to the college bribery scandal?
They're outraged. Supporters of affirmative action say the bribery scheme drives home the notion that the education system is completely rigged. They say the idea of a meritocracy has turned out to be just a complete myth, that the SAT and donations, or in this case, huge bribes, act as affirmative action for rich white kids.
I mean, I got to say, the notion that there is not a meritocracy is not totally surprising, given the contours of the whole narrative that we know. But as a higher ed reporter, Kirk, does any of this surprise you?
The bribery thing, yes. I mean, it's surreal, right? These families were paying to have the faces of their sons and daughters photoshopped onto the bodies of athletes playing sports that their kids didn't even play.
Yeah,
it's stunning that it's come to this point, right? But the idea that parents are willing to cheat to give their kids an edge, not a huge surprise, right? The thread that runs through all these stories, I think, is the amount of pressure that parents put on their kids to get into elite schools.
Kirk Carapezza covers higher education with our partners here at WGBH. Thanks very much, Kirk, for your reporting on both these stories.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, how social media played a role in the terrorist attack in New Zealand. I'm Marco Werman. A live-streamed attack, an online manifesto. The suspected killer in New Zealand posted it all online. Others have done so in the past. This expert says, just don't click.
Every click, every watch helps inspire the next one. We know that the copycat phenomenon is real.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In Christchurch, New Zealand, at least 49 people were killed in a shooting attack at two mosques. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, described it as an extraordinary and unprecedented act of violence.
It is clear that this can now only be described as a terrorist attack. From what we know, it does appear to have been well planned.
It was late last night, U.S. time, when the news from Christchurch broke. For a lot of people here in the U.S., me included, the story was everywhere in an instant, on Twitter and Facebook and cable. Pictures and disturbing details, including a video of the attack itself, streamed live and filmed by the shooter. Also going viral, a 74-page racist manifesto written, it appears, by the suspect himself. Now, here's the dilemma. We want to know what happened and answer the question, why would anyone go into a house of worship, mosques in this case, and kill innocent people? Do we watch the video? Should we repost it? Same goes for the so-called manifesto. Does reading it tell us anything useful? And then what? Zeynep Tufekci has thought a lot about this dilemma. She studies the intersection of technology and society at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Did you watch the video, Zeynep? And if so, why?
I did not watch the video. I understand why, of course, police investigators and detectives are going to watch the video. But for the ordinary public, there's not much information to be gained from watching the video. That video was made and indeed live streamed. Exactly so it would gather publicity and terrorize us. So it's like a snuff film. It was made to make us watch it. The murder was an instrument for this act of terrible publicity by mass murder. So I don't want to participate in that. I know the tragedy happened. I know almost 50 people have been killed. I don't need to see it to appreciate the human tragedy.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, the very intentional way this attack was executed with a camera streaming live on Facebook. I mean, I want to choose my words carefully here, but are you saying it's like the perpetrator had thought about this, like the producer of a spectacle? Was that the point in this case?
It's very clear to me that the killer thought about it very much so. And in fact, the video was clearly pre-planned, and it's not the first time we've seen this mode of act. It's almost like infamy by mass murder and publicity by mass murder. They know that the previous killers have had their, you know, faces splattered all over the news, that the videos of victims running away in terror have been played on an endless loop. And in fact, from an FBI investigation, we know that many of these mass murderers carefully follow, like they collect clippings and they watch how the media covers it, and they also obsess over the numbers. They want to one up the last murder's number, almost like a video game, to make sure that they get this kind of publicity. I'm not saying we shouldn't pay attention to this. This is a terrible act of terrorism that we should pay attention to, but I don't think we should do it on the killer's terms. They're directing a spectacle, as you put it, and I don't think we need to participate in let them be the director.
So withhold the participation, but say someone, a private citizen, is sitting at their computer in any town, USA. Aside from the psychic toll it takes on the viewer, what is the harm of watching a video like this? What does your research suggest?
Well, one of the things is every click, every watch helps inspire the next one. We know that the copycat phenomenon is real. The future killer is watching how this gets covered. The future killer is watching to see what it takes to get their videos and their faces on our screens, whether it be in our phone screens or the TV screens. So that's one big problem. The second thing is it's very disrespectful to the victims to just sort of watch their agony and terror like that. And we don't really gain anything from it. The manifesto too, it's actually a document full of search terms that clearly he thought about and hopes will lead people towards similar extremist hateful ideologies. So he's hoping to publicize what are basically search terms. It's almost like a commercial search engine optimization. You want to advertise, you know, a soda, and you try to get the search term out there. That's what they're doing, but they're doing it by mass murder. And I feel like if we make it pretty clear as a society, as the world, that this strategy is not working, that's one step. It's not the only step, but that's one step by which we can try to prevent the next one from being inspired to follow in this footstep.
Zeynep, thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
Zeynep Tufekci writes about technology and society at the University of North Carolina. As you know, the Trump administration has ordered U.S. troops to withdraw from Syria and Afghanistan. American commandos are also leaving parts of Africa, mostly in North, West, and East Africa. We're talking roughly 20 countries where the U.S. has military operations fighting various insurgent groups. Those battles are far from over, and the U.S. withdrawal could be a major setback. Tricia Bacon is a former counterterrorism analyst with the State Department. She spoke with my colleague, Carol Hills.
Tricia, which countries are currently hotspots for terrorist activity? Take us from West Africa all the way across to the Horn of Africa.
In sub-Saharan Africa in particular, you have sort of three major hotspots. You have Nigeria and Cameroon, sort of the Lake Chad Basin area. You also have the Sahel area and then Somalia. And in Nigeria, the primary focus is Boko Haram and the Islamic State in West Africa. And then when you move to the Sahel, you have this proliferation of groups. You have a number of groups operating. And that's one of the things that has made that region particularly problematic. And we've seen this increase in violence that's come with the proliferation of groups. And then when you move east, you get to Somalia. And there you also have two groups operating, Al-Shabaab and the Islamic State. But Al-Shabaab is a very dominant organization. So you have sort of different challenges when you have one major dominant organization versus a competition of multiple groups. So there's a very different sort of threat picture in these three different areas, and each one poses its own kind of challenges.
Is it fair to say that these groups are actual affiliates of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, or do they have more regional ambitions?
That's one of the things that makes the threat difficult in all three places, is you have a combination of those two things. You have groups that are affiliated with Al-Qaeda or affiliated with the Islamic State, but that are also very locally and regionally embedded. They are groups that have exploited local grievances, have exploited local shortfalls, and have been able to recruit locally based on those conditions. But they also have these affiliations with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, and that provides them with some cachet. It can provide them with resources. And it provides them with a line to those two organizations when they need guidance, advice, or assistance.
What kind of role are U.S. troops currently playing in the fight against these militant groups?
Traditionally, they're taking on an advise and assist and training role. We have certainly seen instances when they are involved in operations, but that's not what they're primarily there to do. Primarily, it's been a capacity building type of role in these places. And there are clear capacity shortfalls in all three regions that are contributing to the inability to bring the threat under control and make it more manageable.
So is the idea for these U.S. troops to help countries help themselves in quelling insurgencies?
That is the idea. And I think that that's one of the concerns that people have had about the announced withdrawal of some of the troops, is that it will reduce the United States' ability to build the capacity of some of these militaries and security forces. And that's a concern because the sense is they don't currently have the capability to deal with these threats on their own.
And what's behind the decision for the Trump administration to start pulling out these troops?
My sense of that is that it's twofold. One is that there is a downgrading of the focus on counterterrorism in Africa. There has been sort of a shift to the traditional great power concerns about China and Russia in Africa and sort of what they're doing, rather than a focus primarily on counterterrorism, which has been the case since 2001. But having said that, I don't necessarily think it's specifically about Africa. We do see a desire to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, from Syria, from other places where there's been a heavy role in terms of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency. So it's a combination of the situation in Africa and sort of a change in the priorities, and I think an overall orientation of bringing the military back from some of these conflict zones.
I've seen some experts suggest that Africa is the next frontier for terrorism as ISIS loses territory in the Middle East. Do you agree?
I don't think that Africa is a new frontier in terrorism. I think we have an entrenched threat in Africa that has grown even more dispersed and has a number of organizations operating at this point. So it's sort of a fully established front in terms of terrorism, but I don't think it's a new frontier in terms of the terrorist threat.
Tricia Bacon is speaking with The World's Carol Hills. Bacon is a former State Department counterterrorism analyst. She's now a professor at American University. So that's the satellite view of the U.S. military in Africa. American troops have been in Somalia way before al-Shabaab militants existed. Remember the 90s and Black Hawk Down? That movie immortalized one of the worst days for U.S. soldiers there. That was before September 11th. After 9/11, U.S. troops were deployed to Somalia as part of George W. Bush's global war on terror, and the U.S. has never left. Despite the Trump administration's plans to withdraw from other parts of Africa, Somalia is bucking the trend. There are roughly 500 American troops there, and U.S. airstrikes against al-Shabaab are increasing. The Somali government is supposed to take over the fight eventually, but that plan has mostly stalled. The World's Amulya Shankar reports.
Al-Shabaab is ever-present in Somalia.
Al-Shabaab! I kept on praying, and God has saved me, but I'm so terrified.
That's from a shootout earlier this year. At the height of its power, Al-Shabaab controlled the capital, Mogadishu, and effectively ruled the country. The terrorist group was driven out of Mogadishu by African Union forces in 2011. But Somalia's fight against al-Shabaab is far from over. The ultimate goal of the U.S. and other foreign interests in the country is to train local forces to do the brunt of the fighting. It's a strategy the U.S. has used in places like Afghanistan and Iraq with mixed success. Initially, the U.S. pinned its hopes on the Somali National Army, but the army has proven unreliable. Deep divides between rival clans have been an obstacle to creating a united Somalia. The Somali National Army isn't immune to these problems, says Omar Mahmoud with the Institute for Security Studies in East Africa.
Internally, you have issues of developing a cohesive national army that takes into account the Somali clan structure. Right now, what you have more so is throughout the country a collection of clan-based militias which tend to respond then more to their clans rather than Mogadishu or a unified commander. So I think moving beyond that is a huge challenge.
Then there are the issues of resources and corruption. The Somali government's power wanes the further you get from Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab fighters currently control 20% of Somalia, mostly in rural areas in the south. They take over villages, impose Sharia law, and even levy taxes for a steady stream of revenue. This video from an Al-Shabaab training camp shows fighters who are often better equipped and organized than soldiers in the National Army. Only 70% of Somali soldiers even have weapons. And in 2017, the U.S. stopped paying salaries for the army, citing widespread corruption. Instead, both the U.S. and Somali governments are backing an elite group of Somali soldiers known as Danab, or Lightning. It's a force that's intentionally made up of soldiers from many clans exclusively trained by American commandos. Small, quick-moving Danab units have had success seizing ground from Al-Shabaab.
The Danab battalion, that has worked and become more effective.
George Washington University professor Paul Williams.
Essentially because it's been kept separate from this messy, clan, corrupted set of politics that is sort of undermining and degrading the Somali National Army.
It's not just the military. The government lacks the infrastructure to establish itself in those newly gained areas. Meanwhile, Al-Shabaab is adapting. Its members often infiltrate the government and army, creating fear with assassinations and suicide bombings. Al-Shabaab has also gotten more bold in Mogadishu. There have been at least 4 attacks there so far this year. Washington has responded by increasing airstrikes targeting Al-Shabaab strongholds. But defeating Al-Shabaab requires more than just a military solution. Paul Williams again.
The key problem here is political. The reason why Somalia has not been able to build an effective national army is because there's no political consensus among Somali elites that that's what they want to try and do. And if you can't even agree on what your nation is and how it's going to be governed, you can't build an effective national security architecture.
Until then, it looks like American and African Union forces will be needed.
I'm very pessimistic.
That's Ahmed Hussein. He manages a hotel in Mogadishu that was attacked by a suicide bomber a few years ago.
People like us, we cannot keep continuing. We can't. People have got limits when this kind of things happen. There is no backup system. This is a war on terror. On your own, you cannot face these things.
Hussein feels he is facing these things very much on his own, not sufficiently protected by his government or by foreign troops. For the world, I'm Amulya Shankar.
Let me take a few seconds for a quick correction to a story we aired yesterday about Japan's far right and nuclear weapons. We misstated the year that the U.S. bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It happened, definitely, in August of 1945. Tens of thousands of kids around the world skip school today to demand that adults do something about climate change. It's part of the growing movement of Friday protests that we told you about yesterday on The World. Today, American kids join their European peers in walking out of their classrooms. One of the protests was at the Massachusetts State House right here in Boston.
My name is Harry Ferguson. I'm 13 years old. Our teacher told us about this yesterday, and I know how like climate's being damaged, and I realize that in a couple years it's going to be irreversible. And by that time, that's pretty much the Armageddon after that. Like, a lot of cities are going to be like overcome with water from the melting ice caps, and all of the pollution could force us to stop going to certain areas. Yeah, in fifth grade I did a climate change unit on Japan, a project with my friend who's from Japan. I learned a lot about how some of the surrounding islands are going to be affected. We did a model UN about it. I do think kids can make a difference. If people see other kids going out and protesting this, they'll want to join in, and after a while we might have a big movement that's going to affect the entire world.
I am Aliana Larting, and I am 16 years old, and I definitely do think kids can make a difference, especially as being like the next generation and as a generation to go, because we have so many resources that we can use. And if we do use that, I definitely think a change could happen as an end result. So when I was in fourth grade, for instance, we had a project on climate change and what it was doing to polar bears, and the ice glaciers are melting and the sea levels are rising. And being in Cambridge, we're surrounded by water. That's very important, because so many resources that have been established on the ground of Cambridge and places that are surrounded with water can be ruined in the future.
My name is Sarah Mounder Maslin. I'm 12 years old. I would like the U.S. Congress to pass the Green New Deal. It's a step in the right direction, even if it's not what we need. And then for them to acknowledge and sort of work towards reducing carbon emissions and stopping them as a whole. I'm part of the Keep Club at my school, which is an environmental club. And right now we're working on plastic pollution. And since our school is getting renovated, we want to make the new school very green. Being environmental is a big part because I feel if we don't do it, then we're all dead pretty soon. And I would like to live older than 30 years old. I'm nervous, and I'm also like, we have to do something, otherwise we're all dead and nothing happens. Like, humans are dead. Like, humans are an endangered race. I prioritize the environment and climate change in front of all my other interests, like feminism, because it's like impending doom, while other things could wait a little longer. Other things are bad, but this is the most urgent issue to deal with right now. Some people, like, they'll think, oh, whatever, we don't have to deal with it, the adults will just take care of it, and I think if we don't do anything about it, they won't. Like, we should be in our, like, band class right now. We shouldn't have to be here. Adults should be in charge of this. They're the grown-ups. We shouldn't have to act like them.
Yep, I agree. Time for the grown-ups to step up. Or, you know what, just let the kids run the show. I'm serious. Middle and high school students here in Boston on why they joined the strike for climate action today. It has been a long week of politics in Great Britain. Vote after vote after vote in the House of Commons, all about Brexit, and all without resolving much of anything. Except for this, Britain will almost certainly ask the European Union for even more time to debate the terms of its departure. So the story that few people understand will go on and on. One of our resident Brits in the newsroom, Patrick Cox, has been editing our Brexit coverage, and he has these thoughts.
A lot of my American friends ask me the same question. Can you explain Brexit? My answer, no. No one can. Not even Theresa May.
Brexit means Brexit.
When she said that 2.5 years ago, and they were almost her first words as Prime Minister, when she said that, it was like she was inviting everyone else to define Brexit however they wanted to. And so they did.
Brexit means Brexit. Strong and stable Brexit. Red, white and blue Brexit. Unicorn Brexit. Have your cake and eat it Brexit. You know, I can't believe it's not Brexit.
It's almost like the X in Brexit is the same as the X in math. It stands for anything. Okay, I thought, the politicians are going to have to define Brexit. But every time members of Parliament were supposed to vote on what exactly Brexit should mean, the vote was delayed, which led to this wild accusation from a member of Theresa May's own ruling party.
The whole House wanted to debate this. We wanted to vote on it. The people expected us to vote on it. And the government have gone and run away and hidden in the toilets.
It was around this point that I started refusing to answer the what is Brexit question. Instead, I asked myself a different one. What does Brexit feel like? Of all people, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, Xavier Bettel, gave me a sense of that. Asked not long ago whether the European Union would renegotiate a Brexit deal with Theresa May, he said this. Don't you like how he threw a basta in at the end? Like he says enough in two languages? Of course, it didn't matter how many times he said enough. Brexit is still hopelessly unresolved. That's it. Hopeless. Hopeless permanent purgatory. That's what Brexit feels like. Which reminded me of something else that conveys the feeling of this messy, on-again, off-again geopolitical divorce.
Let's go.
We can't.
Why not?
We're waiting for Godot.
Waiting for Godot. Samuel Beckett wrote this play in French and translated it into English more than a half century before anyone uttered the word Brexit. Its two characters are unable to make any decision whatsoever because they feel the need to wait for the arrival of someone else, a savior called Godot who, spoiler alert, never arrives. Hopeless, permanent purgatory.
What'll we do? What'll we do?
There's nothing we can do.
But I can't go on like this.
Would you like a radish?
Is that all there is?
There are radishes and turnips.
Okay, it's bleak.
Are there no carrots?
But it's art.
No. Anyway, you overdo it with your carrots.
Which for me makes it less bleak.
Then give me a radish.
Plus, it was written by an Irishman in French.
It's black.
Maybe it is about Brexit.
It's a radish.
I only like the pink ones. You know that.
Then you don't want it?
I only like the pink ones.
Then give it back to me.
I'll go and get a carrot.
For the world, I'm Patrick Cox.
This is becoming really insignificant.
Not enough.
Samuel Beckett, a playwright way ahead of his time. That is our show for today. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Take a deep breath and enjoy your weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.